Thank you. May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for a rebuttal.
Okay.
I want to thank you for the opportunity to present my client's case here today. And our request for this court is that this court overturn my client's conviction based on the violation of his constitutional rights that happened throughout this case. As I get into that, I guess the rights that we're talking about are of two classes. One results from the warrantless searches and seizures of evidence of Bonnie Ish residents. The other is for the court's failure to dismiss the case on his motion due to outrageous conduct that violated his process rights. Excuse me. Turning to our first class of arguments regarding the warrantless searches, the threshold question is whether or not my client has standing to pursue his claims. We believe he did. And we believe the court erred in finding that my client did not reside at the Bonnie Ish residence. And that's because we believe that there was plenty of evidence showing that he did reside there.
Oh, but counsel, even if there was, as you say, plenty of evidence that your client did reside there, there was also significant evidence, including from his grandmother, who owned the house, if I have that right, that he didn't. So why is the judge's findings factually error on whether or not your client actually resided at the house or not?
Look, I acknowledge that there was evidence showing in testimonies that he did not reside with the owner. That the other evidence that showed that we argued showed that he resided there should have led the judge to conclude that he did reside there. The evidence of the fact that his driver's license had the Bonnie Ish residence address on it. There was letters, there was mail addressed to him there. There was testimony from Bonnie Ish that he came and he did stay there at times, and at times he had a key to stay there. He was having his birthday party there, and they were in and out of the house that evening. His clothes were found at the residence. We believe that all those items really weigh in favor of him being a resident there. And we believe that the judge should have concluded that.
Suppose for a moment that we agree with you on that. Why weren't the searches, and I guess I'm particularly interested in the second search, the one that happened during the night, after they left, when they came back to collect the blood, why wasn't that permissible under the exigent circumstances exception to the warrant requirement?
The reason why that's the exigent circumstances does not justify that warrantless search when they went back to get the blood is that they could have got a warrant at that point. Officers testified that they couldn't leave that they were afraid that the blood was going to be washed away or evidence was going to be destroyed. But then they left the whole scene unattended for a half hour at least.
Well, I thought one of the officers testified that the reason they did that was, it's in the middle of the night. Somebody's, they have a report somebody's been shot. There may be somebody out there, with a gun, and they didn't feel it was safe to leave. Given the number of people they had, it would have been just, one person standing around there by herself in the night. Why wasn't that a reasonable decision?
Well, I know that's what the testimony was, but I don't agree with that. They had four officers on scene.
But counsel, it wasn't just what the testimony was. It was the court's factual findings were. I mean, at page 15 of the court's order, the officers were still under pressure to find the shooter and the alleged victim. They needed to leave the scene to take the steps for the warrant. The physical evidence could have easily have been destroyed. The scene looked like it had been modified. So, I mean, even if the court could have found in a different way, what can we overturn about the court's factual findings there that would obviate the exigent circumstances exception to the warrant?
My argument is this. In the face of the testimony, and that they could have gone and got a warrant, that the judge's findings in that regard are erroneous, that they weren't able to get a warrant because of those circumstances.
And what is the testimony? Because I think one of the officers said it would have taken 3 hours to get a warrant. So, I mean, is it your view that they should have left someone at the scene? Or, I mean, I guess, take us through what you think the officers should have done under the circumstances.
Yes. They had 4 officers on scene. The officers, 3 officers could have remained there on the scene to secure it and provide security for each other while 1 officer went to go get a warrant.
And what about looking for the shooter and the and potential this victim or other victims? Who would be doing that?
Well, the officers, when they were all there to get, well, when the first 3 officers were there, they already looked for, they looked around the premises pretty extensively. They saw the blood there by the truck and they followed the blood trails and they concluded that there was no one there on the premises.
Right. But I mean, this is not a circumstance where the exigency deals with somebody disposing of narcotics. This is the exigency of there is an anonymous call and a lot of evidence that there's been a shooting, that somebody might be dead, that there might be additional victims, and somebody is at large. I mean, this is not a place with a huge police force, right?
Right. Correct.
And so this is not like the same as downtown Chicago or New York or Honolulu. I mean, this is a small police force, and the judge made these factual findings, and you want us to second guess not just the officers, but the judge's factual findings.
Well, yeah, I mean, the what happened here is my client's rights were violated, and I believe the judge got it wrong. What, going back to the point that you made, there was still an ongoing, a person injured and the shooter was still out there, they conducted that search and they ended that search. And then they began gathering evidence. And to me, that's where it crossed the line. Is that they could have, rather than going and getting the evidence, if they were done searching for this person, they concluded that he was not there, that an injured person was not there on the premises. They could have got a warrant, but they just didn't. I'm going to skip to the other portion of our argument.
Yeah, Mr. Murdoch, we've taken up a lot of your time with questions. I want to give you a fair opportunity to address your second argument, and we'll give you some additional time for a rebuttal.
Thank you. That's great. What our argument is with the second portion of what our argument is that the failure of the judge to just, in light of what the my client's rights being violated by the tribal's or the Fort Hall Business Council's resolution that threatened members of the tribe who were not cooperative in the investigation with losing their tribal benefits, their per capita payments, and banishment. We believe that that violated my client's rights to present a fair defense because one of the people who he would have called as a witness was a target of that resolution, and at least in part because of that resolution, refused to testify.
But didn't she also, I mean, she, you say in part because of that resolution, but I mean, she was also facing, you know, significant potential criminal liability. I mean, and the district court seems to have thought that she asserted her Fifth Amendment rights because she was in real criminal jeopardy. Why isn't that finding by the district court sufficient to resolve that issue for us?
Absolutely. And I acknowledge that finding and the fact that she was facing those charges. However, I don't think you can parse this out and say it was 90% because she was facing charges and 10% because of the resolution. I don't know that there's any way to separate that. the letter from her attorney clearly states that both of those factors are taken into account, and both of those factors played into her decision not to testify. I see my time's ending. Can I just wrap up my argument for...
Yes, wrap up your argument, and we will give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you. We would just ask that the court reverse the conviction on the basis of the arguments that I presented. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Haycock?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm Jack Haycock, representing the government. I'd like to address the items that counsel addressed to the court. We believe that the district judge's findings are supported by the evidence and are not clearly erroneous. He made the determination that the defendant had no standing to challenge the search. Bonnie Ish testified that the defendant did not live there, and the defendant heard that evidence and other evidence, weighed the credibility.
Mr. Haycock, on standing, it was undisputed that that Mr. Ish was an overnight guest, right?
Yes.
Okay. And courts have held that overnight guests have a reasonable expectation of privacy in part of at least the premises, if not all the premises. And courts have held that overnight guests can have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the curtilage. So why wouldn't Mr. Ish, as an overnight guest, even if we upheld the court's factual findings as to whether he was a permanent resident, why wouldn't he have a subjective expectation of privacy in the curtilage that society would be prepared to recognize as reasonable?
Well, our understanding of the case law, Your Honor, was that he had an expectation of privacy in his belongings in the room that he used, but we don't even really know when he last stayed there. Bonnie Ish said that he didn't live there. He had a few things in his room, and he didn't live at that residence. So my understanding is that he has no expectation of privacy in the curtilage or the outer area of the house, because he's not truly a resident and doesn't live there, even though he had some belongings in a room in the house, apparently.
When did the court find he was the overnight guest?
Wasn't it
the day before or that night or the night before?
It might have been the night before.
So then why wouldn't he have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the area surrounding the house where his birthday party was?
Because he is not the owner of the residence. He was just a guest. He had privacy in his particular belongings there, but he didn't have any ownership or control over the house or over the outside of the house for that matter. And that was the finding of the district court, which is supported by the evidence, Your Honor.
Suppose for a moment that we don't agree with you on standing. Could you address, particularly focusing on the second search, why? Well, I guess my first question is, do you understand the district court to have made a finding with respect to the inability of the officers to obtain a warrant? Because when I look at the opinion, I mean, he certainly concludes that exigent circumstances were present, but I don't see that more specific finding there.
I think it may be an implied finding, Your Honor, and it was because we're dealing with a reservation here of 500,000 acres, two officers and a trainee on duty that night, and then the detective came when he was called, got out of bed and came down, and as they explained and as the court has noted, there was a need to go search for the victim. There was a need to go search for the alleged shooter. There was concerns about safety for the officers. And I believe we can read a finding into the district court's opinion that getting a search warrant that night for the reasons stated by the officers was just not practical.
But what about Officer Crow? I mean, she's, as I understand the testimony, she's not doing any of the things you just mentioned. She was back at the station, I believe, cataloging evidence. So why couldn't she have been the one to get the warrant while the others are off doing the things you mentioned?
Well, I think the problem also was security of the officers at the scene. If anybody left, there would have been one or at best two, and maybe a trainee with a possible shooter nearby and perhaps insufficient security to provide for the officer safety. And I think that was the big concern about leaving somebody there to guard the scene while somebody else went to get a search warrant. They just didn't have the manpower to do it that night.
But that's not quite my question. They had left the scene, right? They're not leaving anyone there.
They did leave.
And during the time that they're not at the scene, you know, some of them are, I guess Tendoy is going to get the blood collection kit, and the others are off, you know, looking for the shooter. But Crow, what wasn't clear to me from the testimony was what she was doing that was so important that it would have prevented her from being the one to get the warrant at that time.
It's possible she could have gotten a warrant, but the other officers needed to go find the potential victim. And then there was some searching that needed to be done for the potential shooter. So it's possible that Crow could have gotten the warrant, yes. But as was indicated, that would have taken considerable time. And during that time, there were other things that needed to be done that would have left an insufficient number of people at the scene with a shooter on the loose, and somebody may have been in danger. And I think that's what the district court relied on.
And the district court also talked about the destruction of evidence, yes?
Yes, I should have mentioned that. The blood could have been destroyed with a garden hose and water and would have been untestable after that.
And as I understand the facts, the district court found there was already evidence that there was already facts from which the district court could conclude that some evidence had already been intentionally tampered with. Is that right?
That is right. There was a rake that was found, and there were signs that the rake was used to rake the gravel and the blood in the area.
The detective on cross-examination equivocated a little bit, didn't he, about whether or not he could have gotten a search warrant?
I would say he did equivocate somewhat. However, I think the district court found that his decision not to seek a search warrant at that time was appropriate, and that was based mostly on security of the officers and whoever might have had to stay behind there in a very unfriendly, potentially dangerous place. I'd like to address the other issue. The defense on the motion to dismiss apparently accepts the district court finding that there was no government misconduct in this case. But asserts that the district court should have exercised its supervisory power to dismiss because the resolution deprived him of the ability to mount a defense. The district court's decision on supervisory powers is reviewed for abuse of discretion. And the district court found that the federal government did not violate the law. The defendant apparently does not challenge these findings, which are entitled to deference under the clear error standard. And the defendant has not shown that the resolution caused Demetrius Ish to become unavailable as a witness. Rather, the letter that her counsel provided appeared to be primarily her pending charges of accessory for murder, which came before the district court issued its opinion. The counsel's letter was sent the summer of 2016. By the 2017 opinion from the district court, she had been charged with accessory, and it appears that that was the stronger reason for her invocation of rights and for her statement that she would not testify. And the district court did not err and was within its discretion to decline its supervisory powers. And the court found the resolution did not cause the unavailability of this witness. And on review, the facts should be viewed in the light most favorable to the government, and would submit that the facts are not clearly erroneous. Thank you. Unless there's further questions, that's all I have. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Murdoch, as I say, we will give you 2 minutes on rebuttal. You're still muted. There you go.
Thank you, Your Honor. With regard to the question of standing, in this case, as an overnight guest, Mr. Fitch, there's no reason to limit where he was or where he had an interest in privacy. I don't see it in this case. I don't see any limitation or any reason to limit that. So I think he was within his rights to object to the search of the whole area, the privilege and everywhere on the residence. And with regard to Mr. Haycock's observation that Mr. Hiss isn't the owner, that's right, he's not the owner, but I don't think he needs to be to have that interest. And so we believe he has standing. With going to the point that was brought up, that other officers could not get a warrant, or why couldn't they get a warrant? I think they could. Detective Tindoy returned to the residence to collect the blood with two other officers. They could have just as easily returned there to secure the residence while Officer Crow pursued a search warrant. They just didn't do it. Detective Tindoy's testimony was he didn't even consider getting a warrant at this point because of everything else that was going on. Lastly, with regard to the misconduct, it's true. We're not asserting that the government, that this is government misconduct. However, the government does benefit from the violation of my client's rights that the Small Business Council did. And we do not believe that they should be allowed to take advantage of that or to benefit from that. And so that's the crux of our argument, and that's my rebuttal. That's all I have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We thank counsel for their helpful arguments, and this case will be submitted.